Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. My next guest is Dr. David Driscoll, who is the former Commissioner of Education in Massachusetts. I've met David back in the day when I was a school business administrator and a part of the MASBO Board of Directors, and he was a keynote speaker or at some of our MASBO meetings, and so I want to welcome you to the program, and nice to have you take some time out of your busy schedule to share some stories with us.
Glad to be here.
Now, you were former Commissioner of Education. I know what that is, and I know who you are, but could you start with just tell us your bio, a little bit about your background, and so forth?
Yeah, I started out as a teacher, actually, in Somerville, as a mathematics teacher at Weston Junior High School, and then went on to teach high school at mathematics, and then I was an assistant superintendent and superintendent of schools in Melrose, then deputy commissioner for the Commonwealth, and then commissioner. So commissioner is the top CEO, if you will, of the Board of Education in charge of K-12 education throughout the Commonwealth.
And during your time serving at the municipal level and at the state level, education undertook a lot of change. The Education Reform Act of 1993 was passed. Any thoughts about that and what those changes were then, and how relevant are they today?
Well, that's interesting that you asked that question. I'm actually writing a book, so that's very fresh on my mind. But I would characterize my time as when I was at the local level. There was a lot of what I call spits and starts, different ways of trying to reform education. It was Chapter 188. There were these sort of one-offs, but nothing really major. And there was a lot of frustration in the state on behalf of people in the field and also political leaders. And then, as you suggest, in 1993, it all came together. I give a lot of people credit. The Republican Governor Bill Weld, the Democratic legislature found ways to put the differences aside. It was really all led by a business guy that was just terrific, Jack Rennie. But the Act of 1993 was a pretty remarkable document, and it changed things forever in Massachusetts. It, as Jack liked to say, it was the great bargain. We're going to give you some tools. That included $2 billion in new money over 7 years, by the way, to bring all districts up to foundation. A little bit of the tools, training, and otherwise. But then we're going to hold you accountable. And there are basically three groups that were going to be held accountable. Students, and that turned out to be a test in the 10th grade. They wouldn't get a high school diploma without passing it. Educators, teachers themselves, there was a teacher test that was instituted, and then schools and districts, and there was an accountability system for schools and districts. So it was quite remarkable, although I don't think, Josh, back in 1993, as optimistic as we were, that anyone would have imagined that come 2005, some 12 years later, that Massachusetts would jump to the front of the country in fourth grade reading, fourth grade math, eighth grade reading, eighth grade math. No state had ever done that. And frankly, we've done it ever since, right up till 2016. And in fact, we read a lot about international tests and how horrible America does and so forth. But if you disaggregate it for states, there's quite a difference in states. When you look at Massachusetts versus these other countries, we do very well. In fact, the latest PISA, we were second to only Singapore in eighth grade science. So it's a tremendous success story, and I don't think in 93 we ever dreamed that we would be that successful.
Wasn't the driving force, or one of the driving forces back in 93 or leading up to that, the funding mechanism that we just weren't providing enough support for education?
Yeah, and I might add that I'm very concerned myself, as a, really a citizen of Massachusetts, that since that time, funding in education has been pretty flat, and there's been modest increases, and give governors credit, legislators, they've done about the best they can in tight years. But the fact is, most school districts are experiencing, you know this from being a business manager, most school districts are facing pretty significant increases in things like special education costs, special education transportation, even health insurance, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the state hasn't kept up. So just a note that I'm very worried about today. But going back to 93, I think that, you know, this idea that the great bargain, which was we're going to give you the tools, but we're going to hold you accountable, we stuck with that. And I think on the tool side, no one ever believed that a Republican governor who would run on no new taxes would ever commit the $2 billion over 7 years, but they did. And, you know, subject to annual appropriation, but they came up with the money. They brought everybody up to foundation. So I think that one of the first keys was the fact that people stuck to it, and they stuck to their word, and they stuck to the tools. And that meant a lot in districts, of course, particularly the urban districts that got some money. They had 30 kids in a classroom, you know, at a kindergarten level, the buildings falling apart. So that was a key. But I think the other key was the tools that we developed, both the frameworks and eventually the testing and the accountability system and even the teacher testing. All of those things, I think, were done with some care and some input. That's what took so long. It took over a decade, but, you know, we piloted MCAS. We made sure classroom teachers were responsible for reviewing all of the test questions, et cetera. So I think the, and you remember former Commissioner Antonucci, who was also a local teacher and superintendent. I think the two of us oversaw and managed the system and the new law a little better than most people would. I like to call us safe crackers, for those old enough to remember when safes had dials in the front. You had to turn the tumblers so carefully back and forth. And I think that's something Bob and I did.
You know, go ahead.
Well,
no, go ahead.
No, that's good. That's it. That's
the I filled in. I got Mal Patterson called me a few years back and said, hey, we need somebody to do a stint at close out Essex Aggie before they did the merger. And I ended up doing a contract with them to be their business manager. But in the picture ID that I had to wear, because I didn't have to do that a million years ago when I did this stuff, but I got a stethoscope from the nurse's office and had them take a picture of me opening the safe. I thought that was a good picture for a school business guy.
We think alike then.
Yeah, yeah. you know, Massachusetts was the... way back when Bill Leary was our superintendent at the time and entered into the school choice realm. And I remember going riding with Dr. Leary up to see then Senate President William Bulger and, you know, protesting. Gloucester was one of those communities that got hit hard by school choice because it became a reverse Robin Hood syndrome to a certain extent. Manchester was a neighboring town, had a low capacity of students, so they were letting people in Magnolia and other parts of Gloucester tuition in their kids for $2,500 a year, and suddenly they all got refunds, and we wrote a check for like $6,000 for every child that they had, and everybody in the town got a raise and all of that. So there was but school choice, you know, in its present state is up and working, depending on how well you which side of the fence you're on. But it's also becoming more and more a national issue. And it was a national issue before anyway. It isn't something that emanated here. But looking ahead at the current presidential administration, his choice for Secretary of Education, and her background, where do you see things going?
Well, if the administration had their way, and I'm not sure they will, we're going in that direction. And I consider it the tail wagging the dog. And just a comment about Gloucester, and that was probably the worst example of choice and the way it worked out. I mean, it really was all those people of means in Gloucester who sent their kids to Manchester. It wasn't the kids in downtown Gloucester. It was kids, as you suggest, out in Magnolia, et cetera. So that was really too bad. That's the price you pay when you adopt these systems. But Choice has its place. I mean, I think our charter schools, for example, in Massachusetts did extremely well, have done extremely well. Other states, you know, 18 states that have vouchers. We don't have them in Massachusetts because they're considered unconstitutional. But the new administration is gaga over choice. You know, that's all you hear about, choice, charters, and vouchers. And that's all fine. I mean, I think they have their role. I think they do provide some competition, which is at least in theory a good thing. You know, I don't think Gloucester can compete with Manchester, frankly, so I don't know that that's fair. But I'm for choice. I think it has its place. You don't want kids trapped. It's become refined a little bit whereby it's more focused on kids who are trapped, in, if you will, in an urban setting like Detroit or something. And it's a way to give kids some options. My problem is, when I say the tail wagging the dog, it's only 10% of the kids. And at its best, charters and choice aren't going to get more than 15% of the kids, which means 85% of the kids or more are in public schools. And that's 45 million kids, by the way. And those are kids in New York and Los Angeles and Detroit and Memphis and Miami and whatever. And I find it so disheartening to think we're going to ignore the plight of 85% of our kids who are really struggling. Many of them struggling, obviously, financially. The districts are. And put all this money into this alternate approach with the idea that, you know, the marketplace is going to fix it. Well, it's not going to fix it. And somewhere, somehow, we've got to address the regular public schools in America.
Well, and one of the problems that seems to come up when people discuss school choice is that you're in essence saying, well, you can, whether it's a charter school or a choice school, a charter school particularly, don't operate all by the same rules or same guidelines or restrictions that a public school system has, and therefore it's not apples and apples. It's also...
Let me interrupt you there. I think that's a good thing. I think the key there is to make sure that charter schools or whatever, let's just stay with charter schools, that charter schools are held to the same accountability system.
Yeah, yeah.
What they do as far as those crazy rules, I think it's great that they don't have those damn rules. I mean, these things about starting school at 8:14 and leaving at 2:32 and all that stuff. I mean, the charter schools, and, you know, I'm very proud of our charter schools, and I visited them often, very proud of our public schools, too. But charter schools get a chance, and think about this, a faculty at Gloucester High School, if they had a chance to push the reset button, say to the superintendent, assistant superintendent, the mayor, the city council, look, we're not going to, all these silly rules we have, we're gonna.
It's up to them to reset the rules they want.
To that extent, I think, but I do think it's very important that they be held to the same accountability. Some people who support charters don't think they should be subject to the same accountability. I completely disagree. They can do whatever they want, and in fact, they might find ways that will help public schools out from under some of this bureaucracy. But they've got to be held to the same rules.
Bill Leary, when he was here, was, of course, he had been in Boston during the desegregation days and then made the tour to New York and then Broward County, and Gloucester was the last stop on the merry-go-round. But he had brought in the Howard Gardner's Frames of Mind program and Sizer's Coalition of Essential Schools. But he had proposed at one point that we modify the foreign language department to include Japanese, Russian, and Arabic. And people laughed at him. I mean, people were just like, we don't need that in Gloucester. And the most vociferous opposition came from the foreign language department. Said, well, the kids don't need that. But why I raise that is sometimes the changes in the people inside the system are not as open to change for different reasons as people outside the system are as desiring change for the sake of change, whether it's merit or not.
No, I agree with you. I mean, I think Bill was very forward-thinking in that regard, and I think we sometimes the system, I'm a big defender of the system, but you can't defend all of the rules.
No,
for
no.
example, it's a system whereby we go to school from September to June as if kids still work on farms.
Yeah, all from the agrarian system.
We pay teachers according to how long they've been there, not how good they are. You know, we have all these professional development courses that very rarely have an impact on teaching, and yet we spend millions of dollars. So, you know, there's a lot to fix, but people get comfortable. The parents get comfortable, teachers get comfortable, and it's hard to change. As you suggest, it's very hard as a system. In America, I always joke, this is the joke, if George Washington were to come down on Earth today, because I always use Horace Mann, who was the first commissioner of education. But if George Washington would come down to Earth today, the only institutions he'd recognize are our schools. And to some extent, that's true.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I often have thought if the founding fathers came back to see what they created, what would they say? But that's another a story for another day.
That is exactly right.
We got about 3 or 4 minutes left. Tell us what do you see? What else do you see going forward? Oh, let me stop it from that. You mentioned in the course of discussion that you're writing a book. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I can. I started out just sort of writing an autobiography. I want to kind of get things down. You know, I worked for John Silver. There were some interesting times. You remember all that. So
yeah.
I wanted to get it recorded. I wanted to record some of it. I've heard so many people talk about why Massachusetts is successful. They give this reason and that reason, and they're usually only partially right. So I thought I had a very interesting perspective, of course, having come up through the ranks and being a deputy commissioner. So that's what I'm writing. But I also include in there, which I think is what your question gets to, I also include in there at the end my vision of the future. First of all, I talk about the things that schools in other states could do. Now, a lot of people say, well, you're Massachusetts, you've got all these advantages. To some extent, that's true, but we weren't in the top 10 sometimes, so we did something right.
Yeah.
I think other states could learn a lot of things, one of which is this idea of putting aside differences. Jack Rennie used to say, everybody in the boat, we're all going to drink a little castor oil. So our law, much to the chagrin of the unions, did have choice in charter, but it also had the foundation budgets. It was a little bit for everybody, but there were things. So I think other states need to get out of their comfort zone and stop mandating things from on high and do what we do, which is set pretty reasonable but high expectations and then stick with it and then give the tools to the teachers, to the kids, to schools, to get the job done, and we're not doing that. I mean, it's the legislators that pronounce from on high, kid can't go to the fourth grade unless they pass the third grade reading test. Well, that's all well and good, except if you're in a school and dealing with these kids, and the kid is, you know, in a household that's got trauma and other issues, and, you know, what are you going to do, just hold the kid back? I mean, So I think as I look to the future, I think there's a lot to be learned from Massachusetts. Now, you know, other states are different. They can do things in different ways. I'm very impressed with the way Tennessee is proceeding right now. They've really done a tremendous job. But it takes everybody coming together, putting aside some differences. You know, we live, as you know, in a very polarized world. It's a blue state. It's a red state. And really, schools are having difficulty coping with students who are coming from families that are just polarized. And so I think as I look to the future, I would hope that schools and states would learn from Massachusetts, figure out how to settle differences for the sake of kids, come up with some common sense logic about standards and set them well, and then stick to them and focus on that and stay with it. That's what we did. And I'm afraid, although the new law gives authority back to states, that I see very little evidence that states, that many states are taking kind of the longer view, which I think they should.
Well, thank you. You know, you mentioned the unions, and I have to tell you, when you're in when you're in the arena and you're going through your day-to-day, you make mental notes of things. And my first week or two on the job when I was a business manager, they call it something else, a director of operations in Gloucester, and you know, the president of the teachers union pulled into the administrative parking lot in a Cadillac, and there were two bumper stickers on the car. One said, "Beam me up, Scotty," and the other said, "I don't get mad, I get even." And I just, and I was like, who the hell is that? That's the president of the teachers union. And it just hit me, and it's, you know, it's just no relevance really, but it's one of those things that you make a mental note of. And if I ever wrote a book about an anecdotal approach, that's, I'm sure that would be in there. But I mean, I'll be anxious to see your book and see what you have in there.
One last thing, Josh, I know we're running out of time, but one I include in my book some what I call Driscoll truisms, and one of them is cut things in half and cut things in half again. And when I go across the country, I do some stuff now, and I've been involved nationally on some boards. You know, this issue, the unions is a perfect issue. I mean, it's a divisive issue. If you talk to someone, they either love the unions or they hate the unions. And I remember we had a superintendent of schools, Ed Tynan, who was a great guy down in Barnstable. And he used to say, "I love my teachers, I hate my union members." And of course they're one and the same. So it's easy to bash unions. You know, sometimes they do put adults' interests before kids and so forth. But on the other hand, you know, who's going to fight for the teachers? And, you know, I've heard, I can't even tell you how many, leaders, one sort of another, political leaders that say, we've got to increase teacher salaries. Well, they never do.
So
the unions have their role.
No, I know that. Dick Lamb.
And I think that's one of the lessons we learned, Jack Lenny. Everybody's going to drink a little castor oil. The unions had to swallow some things, but they had to be held accountable. I mean, they fought MCAS, even though they liked the law because it gave them money, but they didn't like MCAS. But that was part of the deal. So I think we've got to. I understand your anecdotal story, but I do think we've got to get away from this polarization of we versus them, or else we're just not going to be successful.
Dick Lamb was the mayor of North Adams when I was in college there at North Adams State, now Mass College of Liberal Arts, and I worked as an assistant to the mayor, and he told me good faith bargaining doesn't begin and end at the table. It's something you do in practice every day. It's not just, this is what we negotiated. And that stuck with me. I've always carried that. I always had good relations with the unions because of that approach. I was more interested in understanding what the problem was as opposed to what the grievance was. So,
yeah.
But whatever that's
about. And there are some optimistic approaches now with the with the issues bargaining and not the old finding ways to come together and that kind
getting
of
getting to yes stuff, yeah.